Welcome to Slay, the podcast where we dive into all aspects of female health, fitness, and life. I'm your host, Louise Hazel, and in today's episode, we're going to be discussing the three M's of women's health: metabolism, menstruation, and menopause, and how we women can optimize our exercise and nutrition to achieve our fitness goals at various stages of our lives. It doesn't matter whether you're in your mid-20s or early 50s. If you want to know how maintaining a healthy metabolism can optimize your day-to-day life, then this episode is for you. I'm joined by an incredible woman who's changing the fitness game for women. She's directed research programs at Stanford and AUT University. She's the author of Raw, and she works closely with the USA cycling team. Please welcome exercise physiologist and nutritional scientist, Dr. Stacey Sims. Stacey, we are back. I'm so excited to see you.
Good to see you too.
I love it. So Stacey, today I want to talk about the three M's, metabolism, menstruation, and menopause, like three big topics to dive into. I really feel like metabolism is a really misunderstood topic in the world of health and fitness. And so I've brought you under the pretense of you clarifying a ton of things for us that I feel like is getting really convoluted in the media and obviously just, you know, on our various social media platforms. So we'll kick off with a question, Stacey. What is metabolism?
Metabolism, from like the scientific explanation, is all the cellular processes that use energy and release metabolites and how that stays in balance. So if we're talking about the cells, we're talking about nerves, we're talking about whole organ systems, because they all use and somewhat get rid of extra heat and energy. So metabolism is pretty much how your body eats. It's the best way to put it. Yeah.
So is there such thing as a fast or slow metabolism, or are we talking high and low? Because I feel like we're always having conversations about the speed of metabolism.
So when we're actually dialing that in, it has nothing really to do with speed. It has to do with lean body mass and thyroid function. So the more lean body mass, the more your body needs calories because it's a more active tissue. The higher levels of thyroid. So if we're on the high end of normal or hyperthyroidic, that means that our bodies are using more processes and at a not necessarily faster rate, but we have more of a feedback. We have higher fuel utilization because everything is more sympathetically driven. So when we're looking at a high versus a low metabolism, it's not really am I low, am I high? It has to do with body composition for the most part and thyroid function.
Got you. So why are we constantly being misled? This idea of, oh, you've heard it amongst your friends, I'm sure, I've got a really fast metabolism, or no, it's, you know, that won't work for me because I have a really slow metabolism. Like, where is this misinformation coming from?
I think it stems from calories. Like when we're looking at like the 1940s and they started really trying to measure calories, for part of it was making sure we had adequate nutrition available because we had shortages from World War I and World War II. And then people were really identifying food and calories. So people started counting calories and saying we need X amount. Some people put on weight, some people didn't. So then this whole idea of metabolism, slow versus fast, when you're looking at a lean person versus not so lean person. And when they really started disseminating down, it came down to incidental movement. And some of it genetic, but it's not about speed of metabolism. It's about the energetics. What we're finding out now is the gut microbiome has a huge play in it. When we start looking at the composition of the gut, and we see that we have two major phyla. We have a Bacteriotes phyla and we have a Firmicutes phyla. Mm-hmm. So when we have more of the Bacteriotes phyla, so there's a whole bunch of other sub-bugs in there, they're not very efficient at extracting energy from food. So you waste a lot of energy. So this is why people say they have a fast metabolism, because they're not absorbing as much of the calories from the food, because these bugs are like, yeah, nah, yeah, nah, yeah, nah.
So it's just effectively passing through the system.
Yes.
It's like a malabsorption almost.
Almost, yeah. And when we have more of the Firmicutes, they're called the obesogenic phyla, because they extract every little bit out of every little bit of food that comes in. And so you end up actually pulling in more and holding on to more of the energy from all the food. So we start to see that there's a huge increase in the obesogenic or firmicutes when we have ultra processed foods, when we aren't really taking care of the gut, when we are eating at all different times of the day, when we are eating not a very wide variety of stuff. So this is why we're starting to see people will say, oh, I have a really slow metabolism versus, oh, I have a really fast metabolism. So it comes down to body composition and gut microbiome now.
One of the questions I wanted to ask you actually was in not necessarily body composition, but body type. So is there a correlation between body type, i.e. ectomorphs, endomorphs, mesomorphs, in relation to our metabolism?
When we're looking at the genetic component and we're seeing an ectomorph, it isn't really metabolism oriented. It's how the body is structured. So if we're looking at ecto, endo, meso, and we see muscle composition versus fat distribution, the main difference between an endo and ecto is where the fat is distributed, because we'll see ectomorphs who have almost sarcopenic-like muscles because they don't do anything. And then we see
sarcopenic-like muscles are again?
Lots of fat globules within the muscle. So it's not a very high-quality muscle.
Poor quality muscle, and, yeah.
And then in the endomorphs, they put on more of the fat subcutaneously. So it's apparent, but their muscles are really dense with muscle fiber and they're very strong. So when we're looking at the spectrum, it's really again about where the body is putting fat versus muscle, how much muscle is being held onto. And the mesomorphs are right there in the middle where their body's like, okay, we want to have really good quality muscle, but we can also put on body fat, but it's going to be obvious. Mm-hmm. So again, it's not about metabolism fast, slow, it's about body composition.
When we talk about metabolic dysfunction, what do we mean?
So we look at appetite control and we look at leptin, ghrelin. We look at things like your natural semaglutides and CCK hormones, all that establish gastric emptying, how fast your intestines are going, your body's responding to food. So when we have metabolic disorder, there's some kind of dysfunction in the feedback mechanisms of the hormones. Mm-hmm. And there's also a dysbiosis of our gut microbiome. So we're having irregular responses to the food that we eat. So we either have a little bit of insulin resistance, right? So that's metabolic dysfunction. We might end up holding on to more inflammation if we eat carbohydrates because we're eating the wrong kind of carbohydrates. That's a little bit of metabolic dysfunction. We have a misstep between feeling full and feeling hungry because that's an appetite dysregulation. So again, that's a metabolic dysregulation. So pretty much anything outside of what is an equilibrium, because our body likes to be in an equal state, we call it a dysbiosis, or when it's gut oriented, or a dysfunction when it's a whole system oriented.
So what are the, just a quick recap, the signs and symptoms of a metabolic disorder? What have we got to look out for?
Yeah, so the obvious ones are, you know, insulin resistance. So we're having a little bit more body fat, visceral fat. We end up with significant energy swings. So we have feelings of high blood sugar, low blood sugar, especially for eating something that is more carbohydrate rich. So I don't mean fruit and veg, but I mean more of our breads or grains, those kinds of things. If we have a continuous inflammatory response, so we always feel bloated. If we never feel hungry and we eat and then we really don't feel full per se, but we just feel bloated, those are all signs and symptoms of metabolic dysfunction.
If someone's showing signs of metabolic dysfunction, what are the things that they could be doing in their diet on a daily basis to course correct?
There are multi-layers here. So if we're looking at just the basic big rocks of trying to figure it out, we want to make sure that we're fueling our bodies during the day. So we get up, we have a protein-oriented breakfast. We're looking at having a palm and a half size amount of protein at every meal. we're reaching for colorful fruit and veg and other really fibrous foods for our carbohydrate. And we have periods where we're trying to learn what it means to be hungry. So it might be you don't have food in the afternoon until dinner and find out what your energy levels are doing and keeping a track record of, are you really tired? Are you grumpy? Are you irritable? Or do you get really bad focus? So just trying to find out what your personal cues are to tell you that you're hungry. So this is going to give you some insight into how you should be fueling your day. And the biggest thing is not to have food after dinner. So finish dinner and then, you know, you have at least 2 to 3 hours before sleep, because sleep is so important for metabolic regulation. We see people who are like, I'm doing all the things, but I'm still putting weight on, or I can't move this weight. What's going on? And I go, okay, how is your sleep and your sleep hygiene? And that's not in line with everything else. So they don't have really good sleep hygiene. They have poor quality sleep. Mm-hmm. So their body isn't able to reset, so to speak, the systems. So we hold on to inflammation. We hold on to some residual insulin resistance. And when we start getting better sleep, we get better blood glucose control. We start to lose a little bit more of that inflammatory response. And our body's like, yeah, okay, I'm going to let go of this extra body fat.
Got you. It's obviously the things that we do whilst we're awake that affects our sleep, you know, alcohol, the things that we put into our system. But for the average person, how much sleep should we be aiming for in a night?
The sleep researchers are saying between 7 and 9 hours. Mm-hmm. And when we're looking at what does that mean, the best way to do it is you go to bed at a consistent night time. Within a half an hour and wake up at the same time every day. Mm-hmm. So your body starts to get used to being in bed at that time, and you can get into better sleep architecture because your temperature changes. It drops right before you fall asleep. So if your body doesn't actually know when it's going to get that rest time, it can't set its circadian rhythm to fall into good sleep habits. Mm. So we're looking at, you know, that 7 to 9 hour and really trying to make sure that you're very consistent in the going to bed and the wake up times.
Love that. Is our metabolism ever broken? I feel like this is another kind of another buzzword that we're always hearing. My metabolism is broken. You know, there's nothing I can do to fix it. What do you say to women and people out there who feel like their metabolism is not functioning optimally?
Yeah, well, it depends on the history of what they've been doing. Because if we look at a lot of the research that came out after The Biggest Loser was so popular and people were following them, like looking at them, and they lost such a significant amount of weight, even though they put on lean mass. Mm-hmm. Even though they did that, it reset their body from an energy standpoint to not being as, I guess, wasteful. So we could say that it learned to go from A to B without having to go through the entire alphabet. Mm-hmm. So all the processes were not sped up, but just became very efficient. So when we look at the outcome, someone who is age and fitness matched, who hasn't gone through a significant amount of weight loss, compared to someone who was from The Biggest Loser, the person from The Biggest Loser sits around a resting metabolic rate of 800 to 1,000 calories, where a normal person is about 1,500. Mm. So somewhere in that significant amount of weight loss, the body has learned that it's in a starvation mode. And what happens with that is we get into all these conservatory aspects where thyroid will drop a little bit. It learns really how to energize the lungs and the heart and the muscle without having as much wasteful energy because it's still trying to conserve. So when we're talking about a, quote, broken metabolism, we need to know what the history is. So then we can take steps into reteaching the body how not to be as efficient.
Mm. How would that happen? What are the steps?
Well, when we look... And the whole idea is lean body mass. So we're getting in there and we're building the lean body mass and protein, because protein helps support all the fast energetics. And it also helps build that active tissue, the muscle tissue. So when the hypothalamus is reading, hey, okay, I've got a lot of amino acids coming in. I've got a lot of nutrition coming in. I can afford to build tissue. I can afford to, you know, get my bones strong. So it gets into a building rephase, and building is so energy hungry, then all of a sudden things start to come up and people are like, wow, I'm putting on lean mass and I'm losing body fat, because it's a switch in appetite hormones. It's a switch in how the hypothalamus is reading your set points. So it does take some time, but over the course of being very consistent with weight training, protein intake, making sure you're not getting into a low energy availability state, the body's like, aha, okay, ready to go.
Got you. So it's almost like if you're in a low energy activity state, the body's going to be working catabolically, breaking down that lean muscle mass and tissue.
Yes.
If you manage to, get to a place where you're metabolically healthy, then that training is going to reinforce like anabolic, activity, therefore muscle building. Love that.
Yes.
Awesome.
And bone building. And
absolutely.
Bone building.
And strengthening. Yeah. Very excited about that. Longevity all the way. Talking about longevity, for those people that are having them, we want to talk about menstruation. Lots of the young women here in the gym often, will take like a day off, sometimes even a week off when it comes to our periods. Now, you've spoken a lot about menstruation and how to perform and also peak whether you're on your period or not. You've also spoken about low and high hormone days. Give us an indication to what you mean by the low and high hormone days and the various phases that the body's going through with regards to our menstrual cycles.
Yeah, so I'll give the textbook explanation so people can get a graphical picture in their head. We say day one is the first day of bleeding. Day 1 to 7 is the early follicular low hormone phase. Mm-hmm. Around day 7 or 8, estrogen starts to come up by itself. And then we say that that's the late follicular phase. Right before ovulation, we have an estrogen peak. Then we have ovulation where the egg is released. When the egg is released, we also start to have progesterone being produced. So we have an ovulatory phase, which is really around 24 hours. After that, estrogen starts to drop off a little bit. Progesterone starts to come up. Estrogen starts to come up. This is our high hormone or luteal phase. Around day 21 in the 28-day cycle is when we have the peak of progesterone and estrogen. They flatline and then they start to die off. So they start to come down again. And this is the late luteal phase. So it's about the 2 days before you start bleeding again. And then that's the end of the cycle. So when we're looking, we have early follicular, which is typically menses or when you're bleeding. You have mid to late follicular as estrogen's coming up right before ovulation. You have the ovulatory phase. Right after ovulation, you have the early luteal phase as progesterone's coming up. And then you have the mid and late luteal phase where they peak and start to drop off. So those are, it's very changeable throughout a 28-day cycle. But normal cycles are anywhere from 21 to 40 days. And so the variability there is the follicular phase, that low hormone phase, because that's when the body is really robust with regards to stress. It's trying to be as stress resilient as possible to be able to mature a very viable egg. So when women are saying, hey, my cycle is getting shorter, that means they're under a lot of stress and their body's like, well, I don't think I can have a viable egg. So might as well get this cycle over with and start another one. When it starts to lengthen out, then the body's like, okay, I need more time to be stress resilient and be able to produce a mature egg for viability.
Got you. So from a hormonal perspective, what's going on through the course of that month or that cycle, that 28 or 21 to 40 days? And when are the times in which, if we're saying obviously there's a high level of resistance and tolerance during that follicular phase, when are the times when we should be really kind of pressing on with our training and then easing back? And should we ever take like a week off?
Yeah. So when we're looking from a general perspective, we have the generalization idea of what's happening with the immune system. And this is how we look at stress resilience. So in the follicular phase, the body's immune system is very good at fighting off virus and bacteria. Mm-hmm. And then after ovulation, we get a pro-inflammatory response because innately, we don't want the immune system attacking a fertilized egg. So when we're looking at what's happening between the two phases, we're very stress resilient when the when our immune system is fighting fit. We also see that we have a lower core temperature. And then the way estrogen affects our neurotransmitters, we become more cognitively aware, as well as a little bit more aggressive. So all of this is looking at, we're very strong and stress resilient. Mm-hmm. After ovulation, this is where the body's trying to build endometrial tissue. We have a lot of anabolic properties going on with regards to endometrium, but then that switches for the rest of the body. We have more of a catabolic state, which is why we have inflammation. So if we were to lay it out across like training, mm-hmm. we have to put a woman's own natural responses over it. So we need women to track their own cycle mm-hmm. and see how they respond across that hormone perturbation. And the reason for that is we can't pinpoint specifically when someone ovulates because it's very changeable. We know mm-hmm. that there are between 3 and 5 anovulatory cycles a year, and that's normal. We also
What do you mean by anovulatory?
We don't release an egg, so we don't have progesterone. Mm-hmm. But you won't really know that because you still have a bleed, even yep. if you don't have an egg that's released. Mm-hmm. So the actual phases are very different. Mm-hmm. But if you start to follow your menstrual cycle and you're tracking how you feel, you're looking at heart rate variability because we know that that has a significant decrease when progesterone comes up. So you can kind of see, did I ovulate? Did I not? It's but its own patterns. So this is where you can dial in your training because some women feel bulletproof the day their period starts. Yeah, mm-hmm. go hard, hit those PRs. There's a really high incidence, unspoken, but very high incidence of ovulatory pain. So we are trying to push that out into the medical world that there's so many women, especially active women, that have debilitating pain around ovulation and they're in bed for 24 hours because the cramping and the pain is so severe that they can't do anything. But no one talks about that. So that's another thing to look out for. So ovulatory pain.
How common is ovulatory pain?
Oh my gosh, we put out a survey, a 2-week survey, because we were trying to find it in the medical literature and all they had was a definition. Mm-hmm. They didn't have an incidence. In 2 weeks, we had over 3,000 women respond of how bad it was. And so we put out a wider search and it is undeniably common. I think it's probably more common than something like your irregular cycle.
So if
because people don't talk about it.
And is it, are we expecting like similar sensations to as if you were having your menstrual cycle? Are we the same type of cramps? Is it different? What's the sensation that people should be looking out for?
So it's a little bit like menstrual cycle cramping, except it's more severe as a spasm to the lower back. It's a deep feeling because of where a cervix is situated mm-hmm. and the ovaries are up a little bit higher. So as the egg is released down, it causes an internal like severe cramping and spasm. So people are like, oh gosh, I have really bad belly pain or really bad back pain, but they can't really pinpoint where it is because it's so deep. So it's an incredible deep crampy ache.
Does it ever present as SIJ dysfunction?
I don't know. That's a good question.
I feel like in the gym typically, and I used to feel this a lot of myself around my cycle, that sacroiliac joint dysfunction, I used to be zapped with it on a monthly basis. And, you know, seeing that similar kind of pattern in a lot of our clients as well, just that, and it also is very kind of predictable and unpredictable. And so, yeah, that's something that I'm seeing much more amongst women than amongst our male clients. Mm-hmm.
And that also makes sense because with the surge of estrogen, we end up with a little bit more laxity. Mm-hmm. So if we're thinking about the ligaments that are holding the SI joint, right? And then we have a little bit more laxity from an estrogen surge and we do something like heavy squats or deadlifts or a lunge, then we can have a little bit of that twisting and misplacement of the SI joint. So it could either be that or it could be the ovulatory pain. So this is something to track, right? So if you know that this happens, then you can put steps into play so that you aren't experiencing that. And you can also determine. Getting some traction, getting some knee squeeze to reset the pelvis, all of those things.
Love that. So if we're talking about when should we go hard during that high resistance phase, so is that from day one of your period or does it vary for person to person?
It varies from person to person, but physiologically, yeah, you can go hard from day one. If you have heavy menstrual bleeding or bad cramps, this is where the lived experience and the woman's own experience comes into play. Because if you have really bad cramps and heavy menstrual bleed, you're not going to want to lift something that's really heavy and go hard. It's just not in agreement with what's going on with your body.
So basically that backing off phase is post-ovulation, so midway through our cycle, let's say, or and that's when we should be like much more mindful perhaps of what we're doing or intensity comes down. What would you recommend?
About the 5 days before your period starts, I always tell women to think about deloading. So it kind of fits into a 3 week on, 1 week off periodization state if you have a normal 28 day cycle. But if you have an irregular cycle or regular irregular cycle, so your cycle is longer or shorter, you can have an idea of when those 3 to 5 days are before your next period starts. And this is where we see the greatest inflammation occurring because the body's getting ready to shed uterine lining. We're having a significant change in our hormones. So we start to have a lot of mood differences and motivation differences, right? So this is where, you know, you want to think about putting in some lighter days or some deload days. And like I said, you know, some women will feel bulletproof 2 days before their period starts because those hormones have dropped and now they have a very stable hormone profile. So they don't have as much mood issues and motivation issues. So then we're like, if you know that's your pattern, then maybe the 5 days before that is when you're deloading, when those hormones are changing. So this is why it's really important to understand how you feel across your cycle.
Not just listening to the bodies, but also just making note of what's going on in the body. Stacey, I'd love to touch upon our topic for our older listeners, menopause. So what age, I would say, would we typically start to see symptoms of menopause? And what age should we be expecting to things in our bodies to start changing?
We can say on average around 42 to 43 years is when we start to see a change in our power and our strength and in somewhat body composition. But that becomes the biggest question in very active women when they hit their early 40s. They're like, what's going on? What I did last year isn't working for me. Am I not training hard enough? Do I have other things going on in my life? Am I not motivated? Well, actually, no, it's you're now having a change in the ratio of progesterone and estrogen, and you're in perimenopause. And this is something where people start to freak out because society says when you hit peri and postmenopause, you're old. But when we look at it from like a natural standpoint, it is aging, but we all go through it and we are all aging. And once we learn about it and what to do about it, then it's not an aging out kind of situation. It's a new phase of life and you can still keep building and empowering yourself to get better.
Got you. Are there any way to delay the symptoms?
No, because when we're looking at it, it's a natural course of aging. Unfortunately, when we look at all the longevity and aging schematics, they show us all aging in a linear fashion because that's male data. When you look specifically at women, there's this perturbation, this blip that happens in our mid to late 40s all the way through our early 50s as we're going through peri into postmenopause. If we have lots of symptoms, then there are definitely things we can do to help attenuate them. we have like a big toolbox of things. We look at changing our nutrition. We look at changing our training. We look at sleep hygiene. We look at if we're having really bad vasomotor symptoms, those are your hot flashes and night sweats. You can look at things like a serotonin reuptake inhibitor. Venlafaxine works really well to stop it because it's working on our serotonin and our norepinephrine that are responsible for these vasomotor symptoms. If you are having really severe symptomology, like rage issues, severe depression, really bad vasomotor symptoms, you're having vaginal dryness, atrophy, no sex drive, then we start looking at more of a pharmaceutically driven. So this is where we're looking at menopause hormone therapy. Mm-hmm. The thing about menopause hormone therapy, though, is it's not going to stop the changes that are occurring with body composition. Slow the rate of the change, but it doesn't stop it. So this is why it's part of the tools in the toolbox, because ideally we want to implement changes across the board and support the body as it's going to find its new baseline.
So prior to potentially taking like hormone replacement therapy or menopausal therapy, what mm-hmm. can we be doing? Are there any kind of natural medicines or supplements that we could be taking to help with the symptoms prior to getting to the point where we're relying on the pharmaceuticals?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a huge fan of adaptogens. So mm-hmm. adaptogens are, you know, ashwagandha is really good for stress, mitigating stress, because one of the biggest things that happens is we get into a sympathetic drive. So we're always tired but wired because we just can't get into a parasympathetic activation.
Welcome to my world.
Yeah, we're all there. So ashwagandha is really good with that. If we're having issues with sleep and night sweats, we can look at using rhodiola. Things like reishi So you can buy them as a capsule or a powder, mm-hmm. and you can mix them into anything. So we look at ashwagandha and rhodiola as more relaxing, so you can take them anytime, really. If you're looking for help with mental clarity and brain fog, so you're having problems with clear thinking and focus, then we look to shishandra. Shishandra is a powdered form, and you want to take that earlier in the day because it is a little bit of a stimulant because it works on the brain and brain action. Note that they're not pharmaceuticals, but it goes in and it reads what's happening with neurotransmitters. So it works with your body to kind of key it in. And then maca is another one. We always hear about maca smoothies, mm-hmm. and that's another one that really helps mitigate stress.
Got you. Love that. When it comes to hormone replacement therapy, should we be leaning into it, and are there any risks?
So there is this huge thing going around on social media that every woman should be on menopause hormone therapy. And when I hear that, I go, oh, wait a second. That's like telling every woman they need to be on oral contraceptive pills. Mm. It's like, no, it is an individual choice, but we need to be educated around it. Mm-hmm. There are different forms of menopause hormone therapy. We want to look for micronized estradiol, micronized progesterone, because those are ones that have the least risks involved. We also know that the general prescription may not be right for you because everyone starts on the same dose. But if you're someone who's had a low estrogen their whole life, and the body's used to really being regulated on a lower estrogen, then all of a sudden you're put on a standard dose, it might be too high for you. Mm-hmm. So you really need to find someone who knows what they're doing, mm-hmm. so they can dial things in, test you along the way. Mm-hmm. And usually there's an initial 3-month time period where you're really trying to figure out, do I need a patch? Do I need a gel? Do I need a cream? Do I need a tablet? How much of it? So there is a dialing in phase. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing again that it attenuates a lot of the body composition change, but doesn't stop it. So you do still have to do the hard work of the mm-hmm. training and the nutrition. It does help a little bit with bone density, but it doesn't stop bone mineral loss. So again, you do have to do the work with it. As for longer term risks, it's equivocal out there. Like we're seeing that some people say there's an increase in dementia risks with it. Other people are saying, no, if you don't use it, there's a lower risk of dementia. Mm-hmm. So we're still trying to navigate that space, because a lot of the risk factors that are out there right now are based on old data from old formulations that did have issues with them. We call them conjugated. And so that was a really strong, powerful type of hormones that the body was like, I don't quite know what to do with this. Cool. So as we're looking at the new formulations, we're doing new research to see what are the longer term effects. Mm. Of course, everyone has their own responses, and you can't have individual responses that are risk factors. So that's why it's really, really important to work with an endocrinologist who knows what they're talking about and what menopause is.
Is there increased risk of cancer? Because this is one of the main concerns with regards to the women in the gym when we're talking about hormone therapy.
No, because that's from the old formulations and the data from the Women's Health Initiative that was based on very late postmenopausal women. So when you're looking at the data that came out that made everyone so afraid of menopause hormone therapy, and I have done a lot of work with the WHI data because that's what my postdoc was working with. And the study was designed to see if women who were well past menopause could be put back on hormones and slow the risk factor for cardiovascular disease, stroke, atrial fibrillation. When in fact, when they got put on these conjugated hormones, it increased their risk factor for cancer, increased incidences of cardiovascular disease, atrial fibrillation. And when you unpack the research and look at physiology, what's happening is by the time you get to late postmenopause, so 10 years postmenopause, you have pretty much downregulated all of your estrogen progesterone receptors. So now all of a sudden they are being introduced, or the body was being introduced to a very strong, powerful exogenous hormone. And it's like, so the hormones did a whole bunch of things it shouldn't have. When you look at the Million Women's Nurses study from the UK that was going on about the same time, they were looking at peri and early postmenopausal women. They're using the same formulation and there were no risk factors. There was no increase in breast cancer, no increase in uterine cancer, no increase in cardiovascular issues. So the timing is really important if you're looking at using menopause hormone therapy. That's the one guideline that hasn't changed. It's you want to start it as early as symptoms dictate, and you want to get off it as early as you can, but it's symptomology dictated. So this is why, again, it's really, really important to work with someone who understands you and these hormones and how you are responding to them.
I'm going to say it again, Stacey. Why on earth are we, you know, forced into this place of scaremongering when it comes to hormone replacement therapy? Why is that the first thing that we are reading, as opposed to reading and hearing about, you know, the timing is so, so crucial with regards to hormone therapy?
Headlines. Media try and clickbait. So, I mean, it's the same as there was a study that was done on rats that was released last week about high protein causing macrophage. You know, we heard about, you know, high protein diet is going to give you cardiovascular events and all this kind of stuff, because the New York Post was put out this huge sensationalized headline. And when you get into the study, you start going, wait, they're hypothesizing a mechanistic thing from rat models and looking at some of the incidences from human population. But media has a lot to answer for with regards to sensationalizing all these negative things, because we've all been conditioned to look for something negative in the headlines. So that's why we're getting nothing but this negativity across the board.
Got you. And we touched upon it in our previous episode, but just a quick recap. When it comes to menopause and training, what is it that every woman can be doing for herself?
Strength training. I'm going to put it out there. So every menopausal, peri and postmenopausal woman needs to be looking at external stressors that's going to create an adaptive response within the body. because we don't have estrogen, progesterone helping us. Strength training is one of the paramount things because not only is it going to cause a central nervous system response for building lean mass and maintaining power and strength in proprioception, it also increases neural pathways in the brain. So it helps slow down the risk for cognitive decline and dementia. It also improves the amount of lean mass we have. So we have better blood glucose control, better metabolic function. And when we're looking from a cardiovascular health standpoint as well, because you're having different blood flow changes when you're doing resistance training, it improves cardiovascular function as well. So if you have to choose between them, between like high intensity work and strength training, but ideally strength training with really short, sharp, high intensity intervals.
I've got a request. I would love, because we talk about this every single time, we talk about that high intensity sprint interval training. Can we collaborate on something for our Slay app?
Yes.
I would love for us to put together some training sessions, whether it be like 4 weeks of training that people can really use as like a blast off. I'm literally putting on the spot. Can't wait. I will follow up with you for that so that we can give people a really great starting place and a launch pad. Because I always feel like I get the question. We've spoken about it before in previous episodes, so go and listen to our previous podcast about what that high intensity interval training should look like and the equipment that you can use to perform it. This week, Stacey, I was on your social media. It was a really great post about intermittent fasting for women. And you've voiced your opinion about it. Tell us exactly what that opinion is and why.
Don't do it. So when we're looking at intermittent fasting, almost all of the data that's out there about how beneficial it is based on sedentary obese men or sedentary obese postmenopausal women that are relatively sick. So when we start seeing intermittent fasting, it's a way of restricting calories and trying to change gut microbiome and kind of give the body the opportunity to learn what it means to burn fat. Mm. When we look at women specifically, we are born with more oxidative fibers. So what I mean by that is our muscles are more of those endurance fibers. Mm-hmm. So we are really good at picking up fat, burning it, using it as a fuel. We have really good mitochondrial function. We have really good mitochondrial density. We don't have to learn how to become metabolically flexible to be able to switch between carbohydrate and fat. But men are born with a higher number of what we call glycolytic fibers. So those are our fast twitch. And their bodies do need to learn how to burn more fat and use more fat and build up mitochondrial function. So this is where those long periods of no food is beneficial for men. Mm-hmm. So we see that as the outcomes of in male data, we see more parasympathetic drive. Mm. We see a better blood glucose control. We see an increase in free fatty acid use at rest. We also see body fat that comes down. Mm-hmm. We look at female data, we see women become very sympathetically driven because it's a high stress on the body. We see minimal changes in autophagy. So we're not getting the cellular health and regeneration that men are getting. Mm-hmm. We are not seeing body composition change when we're looking at a comparison between calorie restriction and intermittent fasting. Mm-hmm. And we're also seeing no real metabolic change with regards to free fatty acid or fatty acid use. Mm. When we are talking about intermittent fasting, though, I want people to be super clear that there's a difference between time-restricted eating and intermittent fasting.
Break that down.
When I talk, So when I talk about intermittent fasting, I am talking about the general trend of 16-8, 20 hours no food, 4 hours, or we look at the fasting mimic diet where we have days of normal eating and days of calorie restriction. Those all fall into intermittent fasting. Not only do they cause a greater stress on women, we also see a decrease in our gut microbiome diversity. Mm. And we already know that that is not a good thing. We talk about time-restricted eating. This is where you stop eating after dinner. So you have dinner. You don't have snacks before bed. And then you wake up and you have breakfast before 8 a.m. or a snack to go to the gym, right? Mm-hmm. So you have pretty much that overnight fast. And I call it normal eating. Other people call it time-restricted eating. Mm-hmm. But the time restriction is overnight.
Got you.
And what we see in the population data are people who are doing time-restricted eating and they're doing the restriction overnight, they end up with better health outcomes. So that's what I just described. You don't eat after 6 or 7 p.m. and then you have breakfast before or by 8 a.m. For people who are doing a time restriction where they're still withholding their fast until noon, and they break their fast at noon, and then they stop eating about 8 p.m., so they have that 8-hour window, because it is so contradictory to our circadian rhythm, the research is showing that they end up with obesogenic outcomes. Mm-hmm. So they have an increase in the Firmicutes bugs in their gut. We have greater insulin resistance. We have no body composition change. And that's in men and women. Mm. So when we're talking about that time restriction, it's just that overnight fast. Mm-hmm. Works with our chronobiology. So it works with our body's needs for fueling during the day. It gives the body's ability to get in good reparative sleep and allows women specifically to get into a parasympathetic drive, which helps drop cortisol and give us more hormonal control.
So don't skip breakfast.
Correct.
Stacey, we've got a couple of questions from some of our followers. Royce Hughes asks, is one or two runs per week with heavy weightlifting okay, or will it hinder my progress?
So are they doing heavy lifting first and then going for a run, or are they running on separate days?
What would you prefer?
Well, if we're looking at building strength and muscle, that becomes the focus. Mm-hmm. And then the run can be on a different day or after the strength session, because we have to think about when we are exercising, what is our focus? Mm-hmm. If our focus is building strength and mass, then that's what we're focusing on and that's what we're doing. Mm-hmm. If our focus is on improving our tempo run, then we're not doing any lifting around the run because the run is the focus on that day. So it depends, I guess, is the answer.
Absolutely. You know, as a heptathlete, we would always, you know, whilst we had 7 events to train for, we would always do our running in the evening or our weightlifting in the evening, never on the same day. And typically your body almost tells you that instinctively. I feel like, you know, a heavy lifting session and then to go out and run, oh my God, my legs would be absolutely dead.
Trashed, yep.
Very little performance benefits out of that. I love the idea of doing, you know, weightlifting days and then running or cardiovascular days and making sure that both of those sessions are as good a quality as you can possibly make them. And then the second question was, how long before bed should you stop eating? So you mentioned there having dinner at 6 p.m. But in terms of hours before bedtime, what are we looking at?
Minimum 2 hours.
Got you. Perfect.
And the reason for that is when we start encroaching on those 2 hours, we still are digesting. Mm. And if we're doing that, then we're not putting the parasympathetic into sleep. We're putting the parasympathetic into digestion. So it interferes with sleep and sleep architecture.
The body's still in work mode. Now, Stacey, yes. In January, you dropped a recent revised version of your book, Raw. What can we expect with these new amendments?
Oh, yeah. So when I first wrote Roar, my daughter was 2 and she is now 11. So
oh, wow. It's been,
I know. So the first book, thanks. The first book has been around for a while and science evolves. So the basic concepts in the first book are still very valid. But when we're looking at what's come out since then, we've had this huge increase in female athlete research, specifically around hormonal contraception. We look at menstrual cycle tracking. We're looking at more information about menopause and puberty. So just there's more information available. So updated all of those to reflect the new information so that women can feel even more empowered because there's more specificity. There's more stuff about PCOS, endometriosis, menstrual cycle dysfunction. Updated all the case studies because I've worked with many people since then and new situations. It's been downgraded from the elite athlete focus to general fitness.
Got you.
You know, and so there's still elite athlete concepts in there, but it's, I tried to bring it back down to the people that I'm working with now, normal people like us who have retired from high professional sport and now are just trying to stay healthy.
Love that.
And then the biohacking section, because we have things like continuous glucose monitors. Are they useful or not? What about doing 23andMe and Inside Tracker? Are those useful or not? What about cold plunges versus sauna and heart rate variability? So I go into depth on all of those things to tell you what the science is, how to use it, what you don't really need to waste your money on, what's more of a trend, or how you can use these tools to help you understand your body better, but not to rely on them, especially not wearables, because those algorithms are still male focused. So that's what it's all been updated.
Is this the female fitness Bible that we've been waiting for?
I hope so. I hope so.
I can't wait for my copy.
You haven't gotten it yet?
No, but I will. Doesn't even matter. I'll be ordering a copy tonight.
They were supposed to send you one.
It's all good. I'm literally ordering one tonight. I'll send it over to you to get it signed. We're going to play a game now, Stacey, just to finish off. It's called Science or Fiction. Okay, so we've got 10 to 12 topics, and these are quick fire questions. So I want you to basically science if you feel like there's, you know, this is a great thing for women and a great thing for women's bodies, or fiction if you think it's just crap. Calorie counting.
Fiction.
Cold plunge.
Fiction.
Red light therapy.
Fiction.
Protein supplements.
Science.
Ketogenic diet.
Fiction.
This is great. I'm going to be asking you to follow up all of these. Vegans.
Okay. So that's it depends.
Because you are one.
Well, no, it depends on, are you plant forward or are you buying into the cult of being a vegan?
Give us a little bit of more on that.
So if we typically think about vegan and veganism, this all stemmed from a subculture in Northern California who are like, absolutely no honey, no leather, absolutely no animal products whatsoever. But if we're talking about plant forward, this is where people are being more ethically sound and they're eating more plant-based stuff. They're looking at how we can be sustainable and healthy. So if we're looking at plant forward, sure, there's lots of science to show that if you have most of your food coming from plant sources and accented with some animal sources, it's great. Great for a planet, great for health. If we're talking about pure veganism, there isn't anything really to support that. Not from the cultural standpoint, but being so staunch about just plants. And so, yeah, there's a little bit of that biopsycho-sociocultural aspects that goes into it. But if we're looking pure science, science for plant forward, not science for veganism.
Got you. Love that. Another discussion for us to get our, sink our teeth into. Waist trainers.
Oh, gosh. Fiction.
I mean, it's been so long since I've seen these, but they're kind of made a little bit of a comeback recently. I was saying like the past belts. 18 months.
Yeah.
Oh gosh, yes. The belts.
Yes.
IV vitamin shots.
Oh, fiction.
Ozempic. We talked about that before.
I know. That's a hard one. There's science to show that it does reduce weight, which we're seeing, but there's also science to show that that weight is primarily lean mass, and we don't know what the long-term repercussions of all this, you know, population use. In
for
my head,
as opposed to diabetes.
Yeah, absolute science for diabetes. Mm-hmm. And I feel for the people who need it for diabetes but can't because other people want it for aesthetics.
Tracking macronutrients.
That's a good biohack. to make sure that you are staying out of low energy availability. So I will say there's some science in there.
Lymphatic drainage.
Fiction.
Saunas.
Science.
Excellent. Stacey, that concludes our episode of Slay for today. Thank you so, so much for coming back on and obviously having our pre-chat about all things shoulder rehabilitation. Absolutely love that. I really look forward to linking up with you and getting women some more information, especially with regards to that high intensity training. And the information that you provided today with regards to menopause, menstruation and metabolism and intermittent fasting is absolute gold. We just want to say a massive thank you again from all of our patrons and members here at the Slay Gym. We absolutely love you. Keep fighting that good fight, Stacey. That concludes this episode of Slay. Make sure you get a copy of the latest edition of Stacey's book, Raw, now. And stay tuned for more empowering discussions on female health, fitness, and life. You can follow me at Louise Hazel, and you can follow Dr. Stacey at Dr. Stacey Sims on social media. Check out the Slay brand at Slay Athletic, and don't forget to subscribe to the Slay podcast and leave a review if you haven't done so already on Spotify. You can get all of the tools and resources that are mentioned in our podcast on the Slay app. Download it now for free from the App Store and join our online community.